All right, so today we're going deep on a case that's pretty foundational when you're talking international human rights law.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kadok v. Karadzic. And we've got a lot to dig into here, podcast notes, we've got detailed briefs, we even got some analytical takes on it.
Yeah.
And I think the mission here is to try to understand how this case, like, really reshaped how we think about holding people accountable for these kinds of atrocities in US courts, and especially when it comes to folks or groups that aren't like officially representing some nation state.
Right. Yeah. Kadok really kind of changed the game in terms of who could be held liable for these really horrific acts. And that's exactly what we're going to get into today.
Yeah, and I think before we get too far, it might be useful to just kind of set the scene. Like, what even led to this legal battle in the first place?
Sure. So the case stems from the Bosnian War, which was in the early 90s. And Croat and Muslim victims of that conflict brought a suit against Radovan Karadzic,
Okay.
who was the leader of this self-proclaimed Bosnian Serb entity called Srpska. And the allegations were just horrifying: genocide, rape, torture, summary executions, all as part of a campaign of ethnic cleansing.
Wow. So, those individuals obviously suffer tremendously. They end up coming to the US legal system looking for some kind of recourse. What happened when this case initially landed in the courts?
Well, initially, the district court dismissed the case.
Oh, wow.
And their reasoning was based on the Alien Tort Act.
Okay.
And they basically said that the ATA only applies to actions taken by states. So because Karadzic wasn't the leader of an internationally recognized state,
Right.
Srpska didn't have that status, they said, well, he can't be held liable under international law in U.S. courts.
Oh, so it sounds like a pretty significant setback for the victims there, but obviously things didn't end there. So where did it go from there?
Well, that's when the Second Circuit Court of Appeals came in,
Okay.
and they completely reversed the decision.
Wow.
And this is where it gets really interesting. They disagreed with the district court's interpretation of the ATA. And they also brought in another really important law, the Torture Victim Protection Act, the TVPA.
Okay, so let's maybe take a minute and dig into those laws a bit. What does the ATA, what does the TVPA, like, what do those actually do in this kind of situation?
Sure. So the Alien Tort Act, it's a really old law, actually dates back to 1789.
Wow.
But essentially, it gives federal courts here in the U.S. the ability to hear claims brought by foreign citizens for violations of international law.
Okay.
And what the Second Circuit was emphasizing was that there are some violations of international law that are just so universally condemned
Right.
that they don't require that the person doing them be on behalf of a state to be considered a violation.
That's a big distinction right there. So it's almost like some things are so bad, it doesn't matter who's doing it or in what capacity.
Exactly.
What about the TVPA? How does that factor in?
So the Torture Victim Protection Act is a more recent law, and it basically creates a way to sue for torture and extrajudicial killing. Now, the TVPA does have a requirement that the person doing those things has to be acting on behalf of a state.
Gotcha.
But in Kadok, the Second Circuit came up with a really important interpretation of the law.
What was that?
They said that even though the TVPA usually requires this state action to sue for torture or extrajudicial killing, those claims could still go forward against Karadzic because they were allegedly part of genocide.
Okay.
So basically, they were saying that these specific acts were part of a broader crime of genocide, which they already said didn't require state action under the ATA.
So I'm hearing like a really clear distinction between the types of violations here. Could you give us maybe a few more concrete examples to illustrate that?
Yeah, definitely. So the court basically said that things like genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, these are considered to be so universally bad
Right.
that international law holds people responsible for them, regardless of whether they're working for a government or not.
Gotcha.
So think of it like this: the rule against genocide is so fundamental that anyone who breaks it can be held liable.
Makes sense.
On the other hand, things like torture or a summary execution, if we're just talking about those in isolation under the TVPA,
Right.
those traditionally did need that state action requirement.
But the key element in Kadok was that the executions were allegedly part of a bigger pattern of genocide.
Exactly, because they were part of this larger pattern. The court said the TVPA claims could move forward too. It really highlights how the overall picture can affect how specific actions are viewed legally.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge point that the court is making there. So the Second Circuit makes this pretty monumental determination that, non-state actors could be on the hook for these crimes. What was their reasoning? How did they get there? What were the factors they were looking at?
So their reasoning was really detailed. They considered a few key things.
Okay.
First was whether the violation, in this case genocide,
right,
is something that the whole world considers a crime against all people.
Right.
Something so bad that it should be prosecuted no matter who does it. And obviously genocide fits that bill.
I mean, yeah, that's a pretty clear one.
Right. And then the second thing they considered was whether there's international consensus on this issue.
Okay.
So they looked at treaties, decisions from international tribunals.
Uh-huh.
They even mentioned the Nuremberg trials after World War II,
right,
where individuals were held accountable for war crimes, even if they weren't necessarily acting on behalf of a state.
Right.
They also looked at academic writing and customary international law to see if there was agreement that private actors could be held liable for these kinds of atrocities.
So it's not like they were just making up new law. They were really grounding their decision in what was already out there.
Exactly. And the third thing they considered, though, they asked the lower court to look into it more,
okay,
was the possibility of state collaboration.
Hmm.
So even if Karadzic wasn't the leader of a recognized state, was he maybe acting under color of law because of help or direction from Yugoslavia?
So, you know, even without being the official head of state, having enough of a link to a state could also potentially be enough to establish liability.
Right.
Now, Karadzic also tried to argue that he should be immune from this lawsuit because he was invited to the UN. How did the court handle that?
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up. So Karadzic claimed he couldn't be served with the lawsuit because he was in New York as a guest of the UN. But the court quickly shut that argument down.
Okay.
They said that any immunity he might have had as a UN guest would only apply within a very limited area around the UN headquarters in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And he was served outside of that area.
Right.
Plus, they pointed out that he wasn't an official representative of a UN member state, which weakened his claim to immunity.
Okay, so that didn't fly. So now that we've got this background and we understand the legal reasoning a little better, what were the really lasting impacts of the Karadzic decision? Why is this case still such a big deal for people studying international law today?
Well, Karadzic had a big impact in a few ways. First, it really broadened the scope of the Alien Tort Act. Before this case, it was unclear if the ATA could be used to sue people or groups who weren't working for a recognized state.
Right.
Karadzic made it clear that victims of genocide war crimes, crimes against humanity, could use the ATA to sue non-state actors in U.S. courts.
So potentially a lot more victims of these atrocities could find a path to justice through the U.S. court system.
Right. And second, Karadzic clarified the need for state action in international human rights law.
Okay.
While some laws like the TVPA might need a link to a state for certain abuses like torture.
Right.
The court said that the context of broader crimes like genocide could change that.
Hmm.
This is really important for understanding how different areas of law work together and how the type of crime can affect the legal analysis.
Yeah, so that distinction based on the scale of the violation seems super important.
Yeah, and third, Karadzic has been a model for other cases.
Yeah.
It opened the door for lawsuits against warlords,
yeah,
leaders of rebel groups, even corporations that may have been involved in international crimes.
So not just about Karadzic himself, but setting a precedent that really broadened the scope.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned that the case went back down to the district court after the Second Circuit weighed in what was left to figure out at that point.
Yeah, good question. So the Second Circuit said the case could be heard in U.S. courts.
Right.
But there were still some things for the plaintiffs to prove in the district court.
Like what?
Well, for some of their claims, they would need to show either that Karadzic's group Srpska actually qualified as a state under international law, or that Karadzic was acting under color of law because he was working with Yugoslavia.
Right, right.
So the Second Circuit said the case could move forward, but the exact basis for liability still needed to be sorted out.
Okay, so a big hurdle cleared, but still more legal work to be done.
Exactly.
So as we wrap up here, what would you say is the biggest takeaway for law students who are learning about Karadzic v. Karadzic? What's the key thing to remember?
I think the biggest takeaway is that international law isn't set in stone. Karadzic shows how courts, and in this case U.S. courts, can adapt and interpret laws to keep up with the challenges of holding people accountable for terrible human rights violations, even when those people don't have official government power.
I see.
It also highlights how important it is to really understand the specific type of violation, because as we've been discussing, genocide, because it's so universally condemned, can open up different legal options than other types of abuses.
So the nature of the crime is like a key that unlocks different pathways to accountability.
Yeah, exactly.
This has been a fascinating look at a really important case. And for our listeners out there, think about how the principles in Kadic might apply to the world today. Think about the roles of armed groups, criminal organizations, and even the debates about whether corporations should be held accountable for human rights abuses. This area of law is constantly changing, and Kadic v. Karadzic is a really important case to keep in mind as we navigate those changes.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.
See you later.